Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Penny, and this is the Talk with Penny show. I'm on the road again tonight, so I'm not exactly sure what the sound is like, and I'm hoping that you can hear me and that this all works properly. If you'd like to call in, even if it's just to let me know that you can hear me, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. That's area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, that's area code 855-346-3351. That's 855-346-3351. Hope everybody has had a good day today. And I'm just been looking around Facebook trying to see what is new. And it seems that one of the newest things that's new that I keep on getting a lot of notifications about is that there's a good handful of people who are going to be attending a special show on July 17th from 9 to 11 p.m. with Dr. Seth Garber. I'm very, very excited about this. For those of you who don't know Seth, he is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, and The Rise of the Mad Pride Movement, published by Inner Traditions, and the foreword was written by Kate Millett. And if you don't know Kate Millett's work or the trip, the Looney Bin trip, I would strongly recommend you also read her work. There's a quote from Robert Black of The New Dawn from January 2013 that says, Garber critically considers the role of madness in culture and sees it as a positive force for change rather than a disease needing treatment. At the same time, he does not play down the difficulties encountered by those experiencing such initiations, but believes we need to cherish them and appreciate their visionary role in a world gone insane. And his bio, Seth's bio continues, Dr. Seth Garber is a writer, social critic, dissident psychologist. He received his doctorate in 1984. He's a visionary activist in the human rights, green, and anti-war movements, and a supporter of animal rights. He's co-founder of the Network Against Coercive Psychiatry in 1988, and his newest and most important book was just released in May, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. The foreword is written by internationally renowned writer, feminist, and human rights advocate Kate Millett, author of Sexual Politics and the Looney Bin Trip. Dr. Garber has had 4 books published previously, including a book on Jewish critics of Israel and numerous essays and articles. A critic of the mental health system, he has been a guest on many television and radio shows. His first book, Madness, Heresy, and the Rumor of Angels, The Revolt Against the Mental Health System, published by Open Court, Chicago, 1993, contained a foreword by Thomas Saz. The publication of his memoir, Lunching with Lunatics, Adventures of a Renegade Psychologist, has been postponed until the time is propitious, and there are excerpts available from that. Dr. Garber is also an editor of the Pioneering Scholarly Review, the Journal of Mind and Behavior, and I'm very excited on July 17th to be able to have him on the show and spend a couple of hours with him. If you'd like to call in and talk with me tonight, area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, that's area code 855-346-3351. I think that there may be a caller on the line. Your line is open if you are looking to talk. Okay, maybe just listening. If at any point you want to join in the conversation, please press 1 or star 1 either 1 or star 1 to join the conversation. Okay, and then also tomorrow, July 13th, begins the 72-hour vigil for the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration and vigil. It will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health here in Albany, New York, where I am broadcasting from live and will broadcast from live. It starts at 6 p.m. And will run through July 16th at 6 p.m. So if you're in the Albany area and want to stop by for some or all of that vigil, please do. And you can always contact the Alliance at area code 800-654-7227. You know, I think it's important that we remember why we sit 72 hours. 72 hours is how long anybody can be detained in New York, can be detained, assessed, and treated in an institution while it's determined whether or not they are institutionalized on a longer basis. If they wanted to keep you longer than they could. You don't need a previous psychiatric history in order to be held for 72 hours. All you need is for somebody to think that you need to be evaluated and picked up, and that is all it is. I think inside of this, there are also a ton of other issues that we face in New York concerning the medicating of peer services, for example, or the use of electroshock on children, it being court-ordered on adults and most subjects, women over 62 years of age. I think that it is, you know, urgently important that we continue to shine light on the abuses that occur and break the silence about psychiatric oppression. And so this will be the 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration that the Alliance has organized, and I'm very excited to be part of it. Again, for those of you who are online, if you are interested in speaking, please remember to press 1 or star 1 so I know to call your number up. So I'm just, I've lost my place here a little bit, but that is what is going on in the near future, and in tomorrow. That will begin. And so we've been talking about this for a long time, and it's finally here, another year, and another chance for people to speak out and break the silence against psychiatric oppression. I know in Toronto today, there was a Mad Pride Day where Don Weiss was going to be reading a rant about electroshock and the people who call themselves doctors who perpetrate this on folks, and I'm looking around seeing if there's anything that's been posted about Mad Pride Day. I haven't seen it yet, but that doesn't mean that it's not out there. So if you know information about this, please call in. The number is area code 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167. We have been talking about a lot of things lately. The HR 3717 still goes as one of the biggest issues that I think that we face in trying to get that stopped. As recently as yesterday, Tim Murphy had put out an email about the Sacramento Bee in California supporting and endorsing H.R. 3717, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. And, so San Francisco, wake up. Why are you supporting this? They also just passed a version of assisted outpatient treatment, and I can't help if that's in part because of H.R. 4302 passing, which includes the grant for AOT programs in states that have never had an AOT program before. And so if anybody's got any information about any of this, please give a call, area code 267-521-0167. And if you're any of the people who are online and would like to talk to me instead of just listening, please press 1 or star 1 in order to flag me so that I can tell that you want to speak. This is a wild card line, so anything you'd like to talk about, this is the time to do it. So I don't want you to feel limited in terms of any subject. Absolutely anything you'd like to discuss is up for grabs tonight. The civil rights mental health protest that is scheduled for October, just looking at their webpage now, mental health civil rights protest on Facebook, is still going strong, and there's really a request of people to start filing reports and even filing reports with the Department of Justice, for example, and to try to call attention on any level that can. There's a post here about JFK, John F. Kennedy's special message to Congress on mental illness and mental retardation. These are not my language. This is President Kennedy's language. This is delivered February 15th, 1963. Kennedy wrote to the Congress of the United States, "It is my intention to send shortly to the Congress a message pertaining to this nation's most urgent needs in the area of health improvement. But two health problems, because they are of such critical size and tragic impact, and because their susceptibility to public action is so much greater than the attention they have received, are deserving of a wholly new national approach and a separate message to the Congress. These twin problems are mental illness and mental retardation." Now, Kennedy has long been hailed as a real proponent for community mental health services, but as one of the listeners, Virginia, called in some time ago and flagged me to an article that talked about how Kennedy had Jackie electroshocked, and this is while he was still in Senate, and they apparently had gotten into a fight that spilled into the street. And because she was sick of him having affairs, his response was to have her brought to an institution and electroshocked. And I actually, did a little research into this to see if this was accurate. And this was actually also reported in a book called Jackie O in 1978. And so the Kennedys have a long tradition of having the women, particularly of their family, electroshocked or lobotomized. And but when you read what Kennedy was talking about, he wanted community services. And perhaps why he wanted community services was so that it could happen on an outpatient basis rather than having to be institutionalized. But maybe I'm stretching it here a little bit, but I do find it rather suspicious that JFK did have Jack electroshock. And so if at the time the First Lady of the Senate, as a senator's wife, can't escape electroshock, how many people really, really can? But anyway, let's see. Is anybody waiting to talk? No, you're all still sitting there listening. So, hello, I'm glad you're listening. I'm just going to go back to this February 5th, 1963 memo from JFK to the Congress of the United States. So he says, "From the earliest days of public health service to the latest research of the National Institute of Health, this would have been the National Institutes of Health, the federal government has recognized its responsibilities to assist stimulate and channel public energies in attacking health problems. Infectious epidemics are largely now under control. Most of the major diseases of the body are beginning to give ground in man's increasing struggle to find their cause and cure. But the public understanding, treatment, and prevention of mental disabilities have not made comparable progress since the early days of modern history. Now, this is 1963, right? So Asylums by Goffman, which was funded by the National Institute of Health and Mental Health in the late 1950s and was published in 1961, had already, hit the market. So this is post-Goffman going undercover at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, reviewing the mortification, the two-stage process of how mental institutions turn people into mental patients and degrade and dehumanize them through contaminative exposure of electroshock and restraints and seclusion and forced feeding and such. And so Kennedy is making this statement some 2 years after Asylums was published. So Kennedy goes on to say, JFK, yet mental illness and mental retardation are among our most critical health problems. They are frequently affect more people, require more prolonged treatment, cause more suffering by the families of the afflicted, waste more of our human resources, and constitute more financial drain upon the public treasury and the personal finances of the individual families than any other single condition. There are now about 800,000 such patients in this nation's institution, 600,000 for mental illness and over 200,000 for mental retardation. Every year, nearly 1,500,000 people receive treatment in institutions for the mentally ill and mentally retarded. This is JFK's language in 1963. Most of them are confined and compressed within an antiquated, vastly overcrowded chain of custodial state institutions. The average amount expended on their care is only $4 a day, too little to do much good for the individual, but too much if measured in terms of efficient use of our mental health dollars. In some states, the average is less than $2 a day. Amazing how we're in billion-dollar budgets, right? Although, here we say, JFK says in 1960, the total cost to taxpayers is over $2.4 billion in direct public outlays for services, about $1.8 billion for mental illness, and $600 million for mental retardation. Indirect public outlays in welfare costs and in the waste of human resources are even higher. But the anguish suffered both by those afflicted and by their families transcends financial statistics, particularly in view of the fact that both mental illness and mental retardation strike so often in childhood, leading in most cases to a lifetime of disablement for the patient and a lifetime of hardship for his family. If you'd like to call in and talk about JFK's statement or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's 855-346-3351. And if you're online waiting and would like to talk, please press either 1 or star 1 in order to register in. So JFK is very worried about the families and the economic impact of these quote-unquote mental illness that they have no proof of existing for. So he goes on to say, the situation has been tolerated for too long. It has troubled our national conscience, but only as a problem unpleasant to mention, easy to postpone, and despairing of solution. The federal government, despite the nationwide impact of the problem, has largely left the solution up to the state, dependent on custodial hospitals and homes. Many such hospitals and homes have been shamefully understaffed, overcrowded, unpleasant institutions from which death too often provided the only firm hope of relief. The time has come for a bold new approach. New medical, scientific, and social tools and insights are now available. Where? A series of comprehensive studies initiated by the Congress, the executive branch, and the interested private groups have been completed and all point in the same direction. JFK in 1963 goes on to say, governments at every level, federal, state, and local, private foundations, and individual citizens must all face up to their responsibilities in this area. Our attack must be focused on three major objectives. First, we must seek out causes of mental illness and of mental retardation and eradicate them. Here, more than in any other area, an ounce of prevention is worth more than a pound of cure. Just eradicate us, I guess. For prevention is far more desirable for all concerned. It is far more economical, and it is far more likely to be successful. Prevention will require both selected specific programs directed especially at known causes. What are the known causes, JFK? And the general strengthening of our fundamental community, social welfare, and educational programs, which can do much to eliminate or correct the harsh environmental conditions which are often associated with mental retardation and mental illness. The proposals contained in my earlier message to the Congress on education and those which will be contained in a later message I will send on the nation's health will also help achieve this objective. If you would like to talk about this or anything else, please call in at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. So Kennedy's second thing is that we must strengthen the underlying resources and knowledge, above all, of skilled manpower, which are necessary. Are necessary to mount, hold on for a second. Second, we must strengthen the underlying resources of knowledge and above all of skilled manpower, which are necessary to mount and sustain our attack on mental disability for many years to come. So if any of you have felt like you're under attack, if you have been like psychiatrically assigned and you feel like you're being attacked by people, well, here we are. We must strengthen our underlying resources of knowledge and above all skilled manpower, which are necessary to mount and sustain our attack on mental disability for many years to come. Personnel from many of the same professions serve both the mentally ill and the mentally retarded. We must increase our existing training programs and launch new ones. For our efforts cannot succeed unless we increase by several fold in the next decade the number of professionals and sub-professional personnel who work in these fields. My proposals on the health professions and aid for higher education are essential to this goal, and both the proposed youth employment program and the National Service Corps can be of immense help. We must also expand our research efforts if we are to learn more about how to prevent and treat the crippling or malfunction of the mind. Third, strengthen and improve the programs and facilities serving the mentally ill and the mentally retarded. The emphasis should be upon timely and intensive diagnosis, treatment, training, and rehabilitation so that the mentally afflicted can be cured or their functions restored to the extent possible. Services to both the mentally ill and to the mentally retarded must be community-based and provide a range of services to meet community needs. It is with these objectives in mind that I am proposing a new approach to mental illness and to mental retardation. This approach is designed in large measure to use federal resources to stimulate state, local, and private action. When carried out, reliance on the cold mercy of custodial isolation will be supplanted by the open warmth of community concern and capability. Emphasis on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation will be substituted for a desultory interest in confining patients in an institution to wither away. In an effort to hold domestic expenditures down in a period of tax reduction, I have postponed new programs and reduced added expenditures in all areas that could be done. But we cannot afford to postpone any longer a reversal in our approach to mental affliction. Far too long, the shabby treatment of the many millions of mentally disabled in custodial institutions and many millions more now in communities needing help has been justified on grounds of inadequate funds, further studies, and future promises. We can procrastinate no more. The National Mental Health Program and the National Program to Combat Mental Retardation herein proposed warrant prompt congressional attention. So in 1963, some of the statistics that were being thrown around were that nearly one-fifth of the 279 state mental institutions are a fire and health hazard. Three-quarters of them were open prior to World War I. Nearly half of the 530,000 patients in state mental hospitals are in institutions with over 3,000 patients where individual care and consideration are almost impossible. Many of these institutions have had less than half the professional staff required, and 45% of the inmates have been hospitalized continuously for 10 years or more. And so while many people have been let out into the community and the deinstitutionalization movement did in many ways shut down these institutions and bring out many people, not all people, because there are still people locked up right now all over this country and certainly all over the world who are institutionalized. There are people like the Treatment Advocacy Center who are supporting a quote-unquote re-institutionalization movement. And so what has happened largely is that these things like involuntary outpatient commitment laws are going to work in a fashion that will create people and put them in jeopardy for being institutionalized, because if you break the court order, then it gives them right to institutionalize you. And so we have quite the fight on our hands, and I'm not sure what the best way of going about, winning it is going to be. But we must keep on speaking out, and we making our voices heard and letting people know how it is that we see the situation. Because, you know, Pat, who was on last night, made a really important statement. Anti-psychiatry is for something, and what it is for human rights. And our human rights are all too often swept under the carpet and not seen as something that is necessary to protect, or is often also even seen, if you bring it out as an issue, as something that is political instead of, within the realm of changing. So in other words, if you try to challenge the idea of psychiatry and any of, ask where is the evidence of psychiatry, like even in a court hearing where somebody is being forced to comply with psychiatry, and you say, well, where is the evidence of any of these kinds of quote-unquote mental illnesses or any of this, you're then told that that's a political statement that you're making. And I still don't understand how it's a political statement to ask a question about the truth of something. And I think that that's what needs to be exposed. I'm very much on the road here, and so I know that there are several people who are online. I'm going to open up these lines and just see if anybody wants to talk. I'm going to open them up one at a time. Area code 330, your line is open. Okay,
Oh, I didn't even know I was on. I thought I just got you to press star one or something. Okay. It's David. I agree with what you're saying. A lot of these people, in my experience, is when they bear false witness and directly lie to police and people in a position to do somebody harm, that's wrong, because there are people that need help, whatever it may be, and they're being denied help. I mean, the police and other people need to be involved and to protect the community, not to be involved with, you know, this rhetoric about this person's that or this person's this. I mean, when you got people from like this area, like there was Jeffrey Dahmer was from this area, when they need to be, you know, looking for people like that, not all these false leads and stuff. That's my bone to pick, so to speak. So I just see this. It's criminal that they use this psychiatric labeling to disable people when the money's allocated from the government, from the taxpayers, for to go after people like Dahmer or other people that are heinous criminals. I can't understand why they would try to utilize United States taxpayers' money to fabricate lies about people to put them in jail. That's a crime against the we the people, so to speak, using their money. So that's all I can say.
I think that's very interesting. And and the overwhelming majority of people that are getting caught up in here are Jeffrey Dahmer, right? They're people who have, for one reason or another, upset the powers that be, and then for the rest of their lives, or at least some long period of time, they have to continually defend why they shouldn't have to be under psychiatric monitoring while they are. And it's not just monitoring. It's forced compliance with psychiatry, and so that's like where you live, sometimes even where you work, because if part of the mandate is to go to program 3 days a week or something like that, very hard to get a job around AOT schedules or court hearings or such, and especially when it's an issue of supposed danger to self, where there's been no criminal behavior, but they say that just you simply not, taking the drugs is a valid enough complaint to be able to force somebody into this. I think that this is where the real problems are. So I pulled you in because I saw that I recognized the number and I wasn't sure, and I didn't know how much longer I would be on tonight. So I did, if you were wanting to speak, I did want to bring you in to the conversation.
Lord, thank you very much, Doctor. The thing is, I don't want to talk too much about my particular case because I don't want to, bring any unnecessary, bring evil eye in on me, so to speak. So, but the problem is, like, and I assure you, that when people say that you're going to do something or that, it's wrong. And with me, I got to be careful of drug-seeking behavior because this all started when I started, taking my mother's benzo, diazepam, when I was a young kid. I didn't really know what I was doing. I thought it was like candy or something. So, it's almost like imprinting. It starts it off with some people, and you don't know it's an addictive substance, and then you're on to other things. So, but it's a difficult situation. If I was a taxpayer, I would be very concerned about this because I wouldn't want my money to be used to harm people unnecessarily, that haven't done anything wrong. I mean, that's against the Constitution. It's really a crime against, not only against humanity, but against the United States from within. I don't want to go on too much on it. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, David. And this whole taxpayer issue, like with H.R. 3717, the Murphy Bill, the AOT grant program that was actually passed in H.R. 4302 and is being funded, where they have these, up to 50 grants for places that haven't created AOT programs to start them. What this is paying for is a legal process. And so it's paying the grant isn't actually paying for mental health services for an individual. The grant is paying for people to figure out who should be petitioned for AOT. Once they find those people, the grant pays people to write out the petitions. The grant pays for the court hearings and all of the court costs for the judges and the defenders and the prosecutors. And then it pays people to make sure that the people are complying with the psychiatric treatment plan that's been written, but it doesn't actually pay for mental health services. And so for people to really realize that this is you know, what they're doing with taxpayer dollars is just such a concern, and the average citizen really should be up in arms about the damage that psychiatry is winding up doing for and that they're paying for. Line 814, your line is open.
Hello.
Hi. If you have a computer on or if you're on speakerphone, could you just turn that down or just take the speaker off? Because there's a little bit of feedback, but you're live.
Okay, I shut the speaker off.
Okay, great. You're on live. Hi. How are you tonight?
I'm good, honey. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. What would you like to talk about?
Honey, I've been fighting a fight here in Erie, Pennsylvania for over 5 years now of a case of self-defense that turned to murder because the arresting officer was related to the kid that my son was forced to shoot while on 911 begging for help. Just trying to get this injustice out to all who believe in the Second Amendment and the issues that can arise when you pull that trigger.
Okay, so for somebody like me who knows nothing of what you're talking about, can you break it down?
Okay, my son was on his way to my house when he was stopped by two gentlemen. The one approached the side of his car, opened the door, started pounding on him, pulling him from the car. When my son got to his seat, he shoved him towards the rear of the vehicle, drew his weapon, which he had a concealed carry for. The weapon belonged to him. The media put out there that it wasn't his gun. I have the, you know, bill of sale for it. But the young man that my son was forced to shoot had a blood alcohol level of 0.14 plus hydrocodone at rec levels. And he was also related to the arresting officer. The arresting officer was his cousin. And a bunch of things came up missing in his case. And I was not there the day that it happened, but I have a police scanner, and I heard the call come over the scanner. And according to my cell phone records, the call was 5 minutes 32 seconds. But the tape played at trial was around 5 minutes, and I do have that up and running on YouTube with all the documents supporting my claim under Justice for Joel.
Justice for Joel.
Yes, ma'am.
Huh. And so where is it at now?
Well, we did not have $50,000 to $100,000 for an attorney. We ended up with a public defender from Jump Street. We ended up pulling about $15,000 together. The NRA paid $5,000. So we pulled together almost $10,000. And brought a guy up from Pittsburgh, but the judge basically said, okay, I'll switch attorneys, but it's November, and you have to be ready for trial by January. And the attorney thought, you know, with looking at it a couple months in advance, he could be prepared. Well, the judge switched attorneys but closed discovery, to where we couldn't get any of the things that the initial court-appointed attorney did not get. There was a video that was turned over to police that is missing. Like I said, the 911 call, my cell phone records say it's 5 minutes 32 seconds. The tape played at trial was 5 minutes. And like I said, I know what's missing on that tape because I heard the call dispatched, and what, you know, I had just gotten out of the shower, went in my room to change, and heard it come over the scanner, all cars. We've got a guy on 911 who's got a guy at gunpoint. The other kid's got a knife. That statement is not on his 911 tape. And after that was said, I made a comment, if the SOB comes at you, shoot him. After I made that comment, it came over the scanner, the shooter's requesting an ambulance. And that is not on his 911 tape.
Huh. Wow.
But
are you in Murphy's district? Just out of curiosity.
I'm Erie, Pennsylvania. So I'm up northeastern.
Okay. And so is Joel in prison now?
Yes, he was sentenced to 17 to 34 years. He got 12 to 24 for the shooting. There was also a brother involved that, after he had shot the kid that came after his gun, the brother came running at him. My son then pointed the gun at him and told him not to come any closer, in which he did not. He was never even touched, and my son got 5 to 10 years for aggravated assault with serious bodily injury for the brother. So he was sentenced a total to 17 to 34. After we had the initial contact with the paid attorney that the NRA helped us pay, we didn't have money for an attorney after that, so he ended up with court appointed on his appeals. And from what we understand, the last attorney that filed an appeal never sent him the paperwork, so now we're too late to file a federal. But my son did file some sort of extension for the appeal because of that, so we're waiting on a decision from that right now.
Wow, and so the Justice for Joel website, is that a .org or a .com? Or?
I have it up and running on YouTube. Since the shooting, I've had a couple of friends put up a couple different sites. I'm not very good on it, so it's only on YouTube, and then there's a link from the YouTube video that will take you to the Facebook pictures. And that has all the documents supporting my claim, the police report, the cell phone records. If anybody would want to call me, my number's the first call after the 911 call, after I heard the car called out on the scanner. My son was on his way to my house, and I knew that. And when the area got called out and the cops got to the scene, they called out a purple Saturn, and I knew it could possibly be my son.
Well.
But to all you Second Amendment believers, it can happen.
What exactly?
And, you know, you pull your gun in self-defense, have to shoot the person because they're coming at you. He had his hand on the gun. They were struggling over the gun. And the evidence was lost. You know, people need to start thinking over the Second Amendment, I guess, for cleaning up the justice system in the media. What the media puts out is, you know, not fact.
Right. Well, that is for sure. So I think that if people are listening and they want to find out more information about what your case is about, it's Justice for Joel on YouTube, and that
yes,
will link
ma'am.
You to a Facebook, and that will link you to a Facebook page. Well,
I
wish you luck, and I think, you know, the Second Amendment is just one of the things that is currently under attack, and so I think that it's important that people realize that there is, especially, for people who have psychiatric history, this is part of what they're, you know, going after. But even the idea of just self-defense, if you know, any piece of information gets wiped out, then you can potentially lose your position that it was, or the validity of where it was self-defense. And I think that
exactly.
That's probably just as scary a prospect that people should be aware of.
Well,
and
as his mother, it's killing me. I hear that 911 dispatch or the police call dispatch every day in my head. But, you know, my advice, before you pull that trigger, ask who they're related to.
Right, because this person was related to the responding
police. The arresting officer.
The arresting officer.
Yes, ma'am.
Sounds like a...
Yes, the young man shot was Jason Sack. The arresting officer was Jacob Sack.
Sounds like it can be a very convoluted and complicated situation.
It's been
hell. You're facing. I imagine, how long has this been going on?
It's over 5 years now.
Wow. And so from a perspective of a mother who has been dealing with this for 5 years, it's got to be a real strain on you.
Well, my heart and my blessings go out to every mother out there that knows their child is truly falsely incarcerated. Because if I knew my son just shot this kid, I'd be the first to tell him, "You messed up, son." But that's not, they made my son out to be a monster. And he's not.
I think that's a shame, and are you there?
That's what kills me the most. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, and I think that this is definitely something that people are dealing with every day of when they're incarcerated for false grounds, whether in a prison or in a psychiatric institution, and that their word is not seen as valid or reliable, and you know, really looking for justice if this is the situation, and that there are so many people and so many family members who are also living on the other side of that, and not every family member is part of an organization that's trying to get their kid locked up. Some of them are actually trying to get them out.
Well, I won't stop till the truth comes out. You know, you can show me that video that's missing, and it shows my son just shot him. I would take everything down off this computer, but I know that's not the case. And like I said, I wasn't there that day. I heard the entire call dispatched up until the point where they called out the purple Saturn, and then I went into my other son's room and said, "Oh, my God, I think your brother's been involved in a shooting." And I panicked for a few minutes, and then I called his number. First time he didn't answer, I called back. The second time he picked up, he said, "Mama, I just shot somebody." I said, "No, I know, buddy. I heard it on the scanner." I said, "Are you okay?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Have you been cut?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, do you know where they're taking you?" He said, "No." I said, "More than likely, if you're okay, they're going to take you to the police station." I immediately left my house, stopped at the scene because it was en route to the police station. My son's fiancé's mother was also at the scene, and she headed out to my son's house to pick up the daughter, and I headed to the police station, and we all met up at the police station.
And it's been going on ever since.
And it's been a nightmare ever since. I just want the truth. Give me the 911 call that is 5 minutes, 32 seconds, and give me the video. And if that shows my son just killed this young man, I will still love him. I will still support him. But I'll be the first to say, you do your time. But I know this is not the case.
It's got to be a hard place for a parent to be.
Well, you know, you see all these exonerees on TV and, you know, their parents. Honest to God, I do not know how they get through the day. I can tell you I get through the day by the comments or the people sharing my son's story. But there's some days that I don't know how I get through.
I hear that. And so people can go on YouTube and look at for Justice for Joel, J-O-E-L,
yes.
Right? And then
yes,
that'll
ma'am.
Also bring you to the Facebook page that has all of what you're presenting as evidence and perhaps ways that people might be able to support or help you in drawing attention to this and coming to their own conclusions about based on what it is you presented on what's happened. And so I also will look at it when I get onto when I get off the road, and I will connect with you through Facebook if we're not already connected. And you know, maybe in the future there's something that we can do to draw some more attention to it.
That would be a blessing, honey. I would be ever so grateful, and I swear on my grandson's life, if we had the stuff that was missing, it would show that this was a textbook self-defense shooting. My son also had his criminal justice degree. He had his concealed carry. The gun belonged to him. They put in the paper it wasn't his gun. It's just a mess how the media can put false information out there. It's tragic.
And never be held responsible, right? Never
right.
Be held responsible. What is it? Never let the facts get in the way of the truth, or the truth get in the way of the facts, whichever way it goes.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the media, certainly for people who have psychiatric histories, the media has been no friend to us, and they are the first to sensationalize any kind of thing that occurs with somebody who has a psychiatric history, and then broadly use that as evidence of why all people's civil liberties need to be squelched. And so, you know, it's important to also remind people of psychiatric history isn't the only thing that gets you tagged out in this world. And there are other things that happen that are include what you're describing as injustices. And I will go check it out and look at it myself, and then get in touch with you one way or the other.
Well, I do want to say that I want to put out their side of the story. What they're claiming is they had a party going on, and Joel turned onto that road. It was speeding, and Jason, the one that was killed, yelled out to stop, and Joel just got out and shot him. But if you listen to Vern Brown's statement, he says the other brother, Vinny, they were both in front of the car. Jay came up to the door. When Joel got to his feet and shoved Jay, Vinny went running into his house. Well, Vinny, in his witness report, and they're all online, the witness statements or videos are online, Vern Brown tells how Vinny was just at his house, but Vinny never tells that, which would put him outside with Jay at the time, like my son said. And then Vern Brown also testifies how Jay would stop advancing, Joel would lower his gun, try to get back to his car, and Jay would come at him again to where he would have to raise the gun. And my son never, if you listen to Vern Brown's statement, never left the side of his car. Jay came to him, got a hold of the gun. It was fired once. It hit him in the lower abdomen on the right side, but it hit an artery. and with his DAC, he bled out real quick. And even the trajectory of the bullet was upward. So my son was going down to the ground when he shot.
Really poses huge questions for all involved, I'm sure, and how tragic and all around. So I will take a look at the YouTube site for Justice for Joel, and I thank you for calling in tonight. We just have a couple of minutes left on the show tonight. And so I just wanted to remind people that it will be the 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration and vigil and we will be on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health from 6 p.m. July 13th through 6 p.m. July 16th to break the silence about psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit. And so if you're in or around Albany, please stop by 44 Holland Avenue, Albany, New York, 12229. And you can always reach the Alliance at area code 800-654-7227. This has been a wild card episode on the road, and we will be tuning in again tomorrow night at 9 p.m., I want to thank everybody who called in tonight and David, and I'm going to check out the Justice for Joel materials and see if I can make headway out of any of it, because I think that these are issues that we need to worry about, and whenever we are talking about the Second Amendment, that we really need to look at broader issues that the Second Amendment brings up, and certainly this is one of them. So I want to thank you all for speaking out, and I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out. And until next time, talk to you soon. Good night, everyone.